ability at a neural level? Is it an increase in processing of positive information or a decrease in processing of negative information? Researchers measured electrical activity in the brains of people between age 18 and 81 while they viewed a variety of images such as ice cream or a car wreck. For each image, participants were asked to describe their feelings as positive, negative, or neutral. The brain activity of the participants was compared with the emotions they reported. The study found that the older the participants were, the less their brains responded to negative images, but responses to positive and neutral images did not change with age. While the reasons for the change in responses to negative images are not yet known, the study adds to a growing body of evidence that aging changes how the brain reacts to emotional stimuli.
Now, that's hopeful news. But since we're still young, let's work to make the world a better place, so there's less to feel down about in the first place.
Great idea.
This moment of science comes from Indiana University.
Today's program was prepared by Sue Ann Zollinger, with help from Joshua Brown in Psychological and Brain Sciences. I'm Don Glass.
And I'm Yael Cassander.
In sports, Indiana University President Michael McRoby says he's charged the school's athletic director with investigating allegations that basketball coach Calvin Sampson committed major NCAA rules violations. McRoby says his AD has 7 days to get back to him with results. According to an NCAA report made public on Wednesday, Sampson and his staff violated telephone recruiting restrictions imposed because of his previous violations at Oklahoma, then lied about it to the school and NCAA investigators. Many students and alumni are demanding Sampson's ouster. The University of Illinois women suffered another heartbreaking defeat on the road last night as Wisconsin escaped the Kohl Center with a 66-64 victory. Down two with 4.9 seconds left, Illini senior Rebecca Harris drove into the lane as the clock wound down and collided with Wisconsin's Janice Banks, appearing to draw a foul but was instead called for traveling as the clock expired. Sophomore Jenna Smith was dominant in the paint with 24 points, 14 rebounds, and four blocks, but it wasn't enough as the Illini fell to 14-11 overall, 6-8 in the conference. The Illinois women will now have the weekend off before returning to Assembly Hall next Thursday to host Penn State at 7 p.m. The men, meanwhile, are back in action tomorrow at 8. Tip-off is 6 p.m. Central Time. When the Illini and the Nittany Lions met in Champaign last month, Penn State emerged the victor, 68-64. The Chicago Bulls went into the NBA All-Star break with a win over the Miami Heat last night. Kirk Heinrich scored 24 points to lead the Bulls to a 99-92 victory. It was the Heat's 24th loss in 25 games. The Chicago Blackhawks have wrapped up their 7-game road trip with a 6-1 victory over the Nashville Predators. And Ryan Johnson scored St. Louis's second shorthanded goal of the season in the Blues' 4-1 win over the Colorado Avalanche last night. That's sports.
Today's programming is made possible in part by 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign, providing income to third world artisans by marketing their handcrafts and telling their stories in North America.
Ahead of this weekend's stormy weather, we had an extended Talk to Mike segment in the noon hour today, and that preempted the Writer's Almanac. So let's go to that feature now.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 15th of February, 2008. It's the birthday of Art Spiegelman, born 1948 in Stockholm, Sweden, best known for his graphic novel Mouse, A Survivor's Tale, and its follow-up Mouse, A Survivor's Tale 2, which tell the story of Spiegelman's parents, who were Holocaust survivors, in comic book or graphic novel form. It's the birthday of the internet website YouTube. The domain name was registered on this day in 2005, which has become the internet's fourth most popular website, a mass medium for ordinary people, allowing anybody to put their videos up for all the rest of us to see. It was on this day in 399 BC, Socrates was sentenced to death. And it's the birthday of Susan B. Anthony, born in Adams, Massachusetts, 1820. who led the women's suffrage movement in the latter part of the 19th century. Here's a poem for today by Deborah Garrison entitled Sestina for the Working Mother. No time for a sestina for the working mother who has so much to do from first thing in the morning when she has to get herself dressed and the children too, when they tumble in the pillow pile rather than listening to her exhortations about brushing teeth, making ready for the day. They clamor with up hugs when she struggles out the door. Every time, as if shot from a cannon, when she shuts the door, she stomps down the street in her city boots, slipping from mother mode into commuter trance, trees swaying at the corner of a new day nearly turned, her familiar bus stop cool and welcoming in the morning. She hears her own heart here, though no one else is listening, and if the bus is late, she hears down the block the voices of her children bobbing under their oversized backpacks to greet other children at their own bus stop. They, too, have come flying from the door, brave for the journey, and everyone is talking and no one is listening as they head off to school. The noisy children of the working mother, waiting with their sitter for the bus, are healthy and happy this morning, and that's the best way, the mother knows, for a day to begin. The apprehension of what kind of day it will be in the world of work, blissful without children, trembles in the anxious and pleasurable pulse of the morning. It has tamped her down tight and lit her out the door and away from what she might have been as a mother at home, perhaps drinking coffee and listening to NPR, what rapt and intelligent listening she'd do at home, and volunteering, she thinks, for part of the day. At their school, she'd be a playground monitor, a PTA mother. She'd see them straggle into the sunshine, her children bright in the slipstream, and she a gracious shadow at the school door. She would not be separated from them for long by the morning. But she has chosen her flight from them on this and every morning. She's now so far away, she trusts someone else is listening to their raised voices, applying a Band-Aid, opening the door for them when the sunshine calls them out into the day. At certain moments, head bent at her desk, she can see her children and feels a quick stab. She hasn't forgotten that she is their mother. Every weekday morning, every working day, she listens to her heart and the voices of her children. Goodbye, they shout, and the door closes behind the working mother. Sestina for the Working Mother by Deborah Garrison from her book The Second Child, published by Random House and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation. You can visit them online anytime at poetryfoundation.org. And by the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the literary arts and the universe of great ideas. Produced by Katrina Chikala and Ella Shovanek. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's 2:49 Central Time. Coming up this afternoon on The World from PRI, many Pakistanis care less about Islamic radicalism and care more about their next meal. As they prepare to choose a president, the economy is the top issue. Bread, butter, and the ballot in Pakistan. That story in the day's news coming up at 3 o'clock here this afternoon on AM 580. A Justice Department official who 2 years ago signed secret memos authorizing the waterboarding of suspected terrorists now says his department has not ruled on whether the technique is legal. This comes 1 week after the CIA confirmed waterboarding had been used on 3 suspected al-Qaeda operatives. It also coincides with Congress sending President Bush legislation requiring that all interrogations follow the Army Field Manual, which prohibits physical torment. NPR's David Wellner reports.
In the hot seat before the House Judiciary Committee yesterday sat Stephen Bradbury, whom President Bush has nominated to head the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel. Senate Democrats have balked at confirming him in that post because of the memos he signed that appear to justify torture. So he's now simply the acting head of this office, which rules on the legality of executive branch policies. New York Democrat Gerald Nadler, who chaired the hearing, wanted Bradbury's views on waterboarding.
My own view of waterboarding is clear. It is torture, period, and as such violates several of our laws.
Bradbury assured Nadler that in the CIA's secret terrorist interrogation program, waterboarding is a thing of the past.
The program as it is authorized today does not include waterboarding. And let me be clear, Mr. Chairman, there has been no determination by the Justice Department that the use of waterboarding under any circumstances would be lawful under current law.
But later, Bradbury stated for the first time that ever since Congress passed a statute a year and a half ago more broadly defining what constitutes torture, there's been no ruling on waterboarding's legality.
The department has not analyzed this procedure under that statute, and as I think you can tell from the change in the language, that statute would present a more difficult question.
Nadler noted a federal statute defines torture as, quote, an act specifically designed to inflict severe physical or mental pain or suffering. Bradbury argued this does not prohibit waterboarding.
Our office has advised the CIA when they were proposing to use waterboarding that the use of the procedure, subject to strict limitations and safeguards applicable to the program, was not torture, did not violate the anti-torture statute. And I think that conclusion was reasonable. I agree with that conclusion.
Given the definition I just read, how can you possibly justify that?
Well, first of all, I'm limited in what I can say about the technique itself because...
We know what the technique is. It's been done for hundreds of years.
Well, with respect, Mr. Chairman, your description is not an accurate description of the procedure that's used by the CIA.
Documents describing that procedure, Bradbury said, remain classified. Nadler told him he and others on the judiciary panel all have high-level security clearances.
So can you tell us precisely what the legal authority is for withholding those documents from a committee of proper subject matter jurisdiction other than the fact that they might be embarrassing to somebody?
Well, Mr. Chairman, let me say I and the Department of Justice and the Attorney General fully recognize and respect the strong oversight interest this committee has in the work of our office.
We've seen no evidence of that.
Well, let me say that we do intend and we strive to respond
well,
to and accommodate.
Let's break through all this. Will you commit to letting us see those memos? And if not, why not?
We are giving that serious consideration.
And that's as far as Bradbury would go. David Walna, NPR News.
It's 2:53. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580, online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Celeste Quinn. We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for public telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of Alice and Robert Campbell. Veterinarians who use a holistic approach to healing make up only about 1% of all veterinarians in the country, but the demand for that type of practice is increasing among pet owners. As the popularity for holistic practice grows, the mainstream veterinary community wants to see more science behind the methods used by those veterinarians. Kenna Ullman reports.
The snow's starting to fall as I arrive at a small yellow farmhouse. I hurry my dogs up to the front door and step inside. This is the veterinary clinic of Dr. Conrad Kruse. He's a holistic veterinarian with a different approach to animal health care. One thing Dr. Kruse does is to take a lot of time teaching clients how to help heal their animals. He says it's hard work, but most clients embrace the idea.
9 out of 10 of them do a wonderful job. They do make food. They learn massage. They learn to stretch their animal. They'll buy air filters for the allergic individual. They see that healing is a progression.
Pet owners who switch to holistic veterinarians such as Kruse swear by this approach. And Neil and Joni Alcorn are perfect examples. They found Dr. Kruse after the local veterinarian said they'd run out of options to help their dog Poppy. Poppy developed complications after picking up a rare parasite, and the veterinarians tried everything from exploratory surgery to steroids. Neil Alcorn says after 10 months of this, they told him to prepare for his dog's death.
The vets were now basically saying you should get prepared for the fact that poppy's not going to last much longer. And they didn't have anything else to offer.
But the Alcorns decided to keep trying. They researched holistic veterinarians and came across the name of Conrad Kruse. Right away, Dr. Kruse taught the Alcorns how to prepare fresh homemade food for their dog. They started with a simple puree of natural foods and offered it to Poppy. Within a few days, their dog was showing more interest in food for the first time in months. Dr. Kruse then added natural supplements to help build up Poppy's strength. Neil Alcorn says the good results continued.
It was so remarkable. Within, and I don't remember the dates, between 2 and 3 months, she had been weaned off of every single medication, including the steroids, and was beginning to function again as a living being.
Veterinarians such as Kruse say this kind of care shows how a natural and holistic approach should be part of standard veterinary treatment. But there's no policy within the mainstream veterinary community to link clients such as the Alcorns with holistic veterinarians. Dr. Craig Smith is with the American Veterinary Medical Association. He says most vets are cautious about fully supporting holistic veterinary medicine until they see more science.
Unfortunately, for too many of the complementary and alternative veterinary medical therapies, including some of the nutritional recommendations, we don't have the science. I'm not saying it doesn't work. It obviously does work for some animals. The question is, how can you as a practicing veterinarian develop your level of confidence to say this is going to work for your dog versus this may work for your dog?
So the larger community of veterinarians is reluctant to endorse holistic medicine as part of standard animal care. But this doesn't stop pet owners such as the Alcorns from continuing to use holistic methods for their animals. They're much more involved in their animals' health care now, from preparing meals to being part of decision-making at the local veterinary office. Neil Alcorn says they don't need to go further than Poppy for proof it works. She's still going strong 6 years after the local veterinarians gave up on her.
She was 16 years old this last September. This weekend I took her hiking for several 2 or 3 mile hikes, and she still plays with us. She's gray. She's showing her age, but then so were we all. And we have every hope of sending birthday congratulations to Dr. Kruse next September on Poppy's 17th birthday. Even to us, it's a bit of an amazing story.
For the Environment Report, I'm Kina Oman.
The Environment Report is a production of Michigan Radio. Support comes from the Joyce Foundation, the George Gund Foundation, and USDA's Cooperative Extension Service. Have something to say about the Environment Report? Send email to feedback@environmentreport.org.
Earth and Sky.
Friday, February 15th, 2008. The waxing gibbous moon shines near the planet Mars tonight.
Mars looks like a bright reddish star. Mars and the moon now reside on nearly the same line of sight as seen from Earth, so they look close in our sky. But the moon and Mars are never truly close together. Tonight, the sunlight reflected off the moon takes a fraction over one light second to reach us, while sunlight bouncing off Mars travels some 7.5 light minutes before reaching our eyes.
Viewing Mars tonight, we're looking at a world that's nearly 400 times farther away than our moon. That might seem like a big difference, but space is vast. And on a cosmic scale, Mars is our backyard neighbor, the next planet outward from Earth in orbit around the Sun. Even the closest star to the Sun, Proxima Centauri, is 300,000 times more distant than Mars.
If you look, you'll see a moderately bright star close to Mars tonight, Elnath in the constellation Taurus. At 130 light years, Elnath lies 30 times more distant than Proxima and some 9 million times farther away than Mars. So remember tonight and tomorrow night to look for the moon and Mars. Although they appear close together on the sky's dome, they really reside far from each other. I'm Joel Block.
And I'm Deborah Bird for Earth and Sky, a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Radio Maria Restaurant in downtown Champaign. Radio Maria serves dinner and tapas every evening, lunch on Fridays and Saturdays from 11:30 a.m. to 2:30 p.m., and a Sunday brunch. Registration is available for emails on news, menu changes, and upcoming special events.
You're tuned to WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. It's coming up on 3 o'clock. The world is next. The program will get underway today with news from the BBC. We're going to join the world at 1 minute past the hour so we can bring you up to date on the weather. Mike Solo's forecast for Illinois and Indiana tonight, clear to partly cloudy and colder, lows ranging from 2.